completely in accordance with popular wishes, Paul Hudson isn't actually here for this podcast. Does anybody know where he is? Anybody seen him? Where's he gone?
I don't care really.
Bureaucratic hell.
Oh, well, we feel for him, but
I feel your pain.
We'll do this. We'll battle on without him. This is season 2, episode 21 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
And I am Graham Morrison.
Yay. And in this episode, we're talking about Ubuntu possibly ditching X. We've got the You Dare Us results from our t-shirt design challenge and our open ballot on whether the KDE and Qt libs should merge. Don't forget, if you love what we do, you can subscribe to Linux Format Magazine at tuxradar.com/subscribe and give
it's
us lots
awesome.
Of...
It's awesome.
It's awesome. Give us lots of beer money,
lots
please.
Of pages.
Yeah, lots and lots
with
of...
words on them.
Pages with information and facts about Linux.
Well done, Paul.
So, the news then.
Yeah, let's go.
What's this about Ubuntu dropping X? I mean, I know they're into streamlining and simplifying people's choices, but are they really going to try and get by on only 25 letters? How will they spell Linux?
Oh, with the KS at the end instead, I think. This is Mark Shuttleworth's announcement that Ubuntu may slowly transition over to the Wayland display server, ditch the X window system. The X window system that we all know and love that's been there since, well, the mid-80s,
yeah.
and go for something a lot simpler.
Well, let's face it, X is massively over-engineered for what we use it for these days. I mean, it's a technology that harks back to, I don't know, the 80s, if not the 70s. You know, it's got all kinds of weird hooks on it, weird capabilities that none of us ever use. It's also not designed for any of the kind of graphically accelerated environments that we typically use these days. And I would guess it's pretty inefficient.
Yeah, I mean, it does date back from a time where it was designed entirely to be network transparent. And I have used that bits and bobs in the past.
Yeah, me too.
But I've never found it particularly much faster than, you know, a good VNC client.
Well, VNC's faster, I think.
Yeah.
I think over a network, it's more flexible because rather than sending like a bitmap of the screen image, it's sending the Windows, so this Windows commands more like Microsoft's remote desktop protocol.
You see, Shuttleworth says that X can be amazing, you know, with compis and compositing managers, all this stuff, but it's so hard to actually achieve that, and there are so many...
It's done amazingly well, I think, considering. The kind of tasks that X has been put to over the years with things like X and anti-aliased fonts. Do you remember that? That was a big deal at the moment.
Yeah.
That required patching X. You know, it all seems kind of absurd. And the weird way that the server is the keyboard and the mouse and the client is the thing that draws the graphics.
I mean, that's going to be the same in Wayland, isn't it?
Probably, yeah. Or maybe it won't be a server. I mean, I don't think anybody else calls the graphical interface a server or a client.
Yeah,
I well remember the letters we had you got that wrong.
That's Graham. Yeah, and it's been burnt into my brain cells ever since.
Yeah, I think this will simplify things considerably, and it won't mean the end of all our favorite X apps, because X can be hosted on top of Wayland.
Oh,
the X server can run. Well, the idea being is that GTK and Qt and things that use Cairo will be able to become Wayland native. But for if you really want to run xCalc and xFontCell and all those really ancient xlib applications, xEdit, then you'll still be able to do that. But all the toolkit should be able to transition over to Wayland eventually.
So Wayland is a more closer to the bone system. It uses things like kernel mode, doesn't it? And it uses hardware drivers at their native level. There's no kind of in-between layer between the way applications talk to the display.
There are fewer elements to the stack. There's a good diagram of it on the Wayland website,
which
I can't really describe using words here, but it talks about the fact that in X you've got the X server and the clients and the compositing manager and all these different parts, whereas in Wayland it's just there is Wayland and that's it.
Yeah. And I don't know, but do you know how much effort it requires to port things like GTK apps to use Wayland?
Well, if GTK uses Cairo fundamentally for rendering, then...
It doesn't use Cairo for everything, though, does it? It uses Cairo for certain elements.
Right. Well, it might be a big job then, but, you know, sometimes these decisions have got to be made. You know, Apple chose to ditch its horrible old system to make OS X.
It does rest, I suppose. If they get GNOME 3 running or KDE 3 running on Wayland, KDE 4 running on Wayland.
Maybe they've come out to KDE 3. Yeah.
Why would Ubuntu want to get KDE 4 running on Wayland anyway? We are just talking about one distro here that's built its success on GNOME.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
And it's just another step away. Further away, another chip in separating Ubuntu from the herd.
And maybe, as you're saying, they don't care about GNOME anymore either. You know, with the move to Unity, replacing GNOME, and maybe GTK just running for certain apps.
I'm still rather confused by that. I thought GNOME was going to keep running on top of Unity, or maybe Unity was going to run on top of GNOME, or maybe it was like a sandwich with...
I think it's early days. I think initially they said that Unity was going to run on top of GNOME, but now it isn't GNOME, I don't think, is going to be running at all, but GTK is obviously still there, so it's still going to be all the same GTK apps that you run on GNOME, so Nautilus, the file manager, and presumably all the configuration panels and settings. So everything that you kind of recognize as being GNOME will be there, but without the desktop. It's whatever, I suppose, you think makes up GNOME. If a majority of apps make GNOME, then blah, blah, blah.
I had a really geeky moment just about 30 seconds ago when Andrew said it separates Ubuntu from the herd, and I actually thought he was talking about GNU herd. That was the first thing that came into my head.
Mike.
Oh, dear. Right. So perhaps we should move on to the next one before I embarrass myself even more, which is that Fedora 14 was released, which has a preview of GNOME. Schnell?
Is that a faster version?
Fedora 14 was released, which has a preview of GNOME Shell, and apparently it also has libjpg turbo, which is twice as fast as JPEG render. Really, that's what it says in the release notes. I've only tried it briefly because as I get it ready for the Linux format cover disk, but they had to chop some things out of it. They wanted to put the systemd boot up script in there, but they had to take them out at the last minute due to...
It's been held back for next release, hasn't it?
Has it, for 15? Because
How many times have you written about systemd being in Fedora?
I know. And then it has to disappear. Because there were major problems with actually even booting up into X, into actual graphical mode.
They should be using Wayland.
Well, quite possibly so.
They've got an uber beta super preview of GNOME Shell, haven't they?
Yeah, I haven't. Have you seen this? Have you tried it yet?
No, I haven't tried it. I tried the Ubuntu packages for GNOME Shell, so
right.
I can't really comment on what Fedora have done.
I booted up the live CD version just to test it was all working as I was integrating it into our disk. And it kind of strikes me that the ISO image is about the same size as Ubuntu, and yet it doesn't have OpenOffice in there, which... You know, it's pretty a good 100 megs, so I can't really see what it has in replacement to use up that space.
No, that's true.
It's certainly not media codecs, is it?
Hey, that's true.
It could be languages, you know. Fedora's very good at that
true.
Kind of
it
thing.
Yeah, the Swahili something. The time zones for every
Lib
village in
Swahili
Russia.
Swahili.jar.
Sadly, I've not tried it, but I do run Fedora 13 at home, so I will be upgrading to it.
Oh, it's got really, really awesome wallpaper. Probably the best Fedora wallpaper I've seen, and that's saying something.
Oh, yeah, they've really improved, haven't they?
I really like that. A few releases ago, they had a really bland one, and I like to use the wallpaper on the Linux format DVD wallets because it looks really cool a lot of times. Like when they had the hot air balloons, that was really, really good. And then they went boring for a bit, and now they've got this kind of smashed glass effect, which... looks ace. I don't know if it suggests there are any problems with the distro. But.
Well, if you get bored with your desktops, obviously you can download a desktop image from TuxRadar.
That's true.
We've desktop imagerized a few of our tastiest covers, and they're there at a link, which will no doubt be in the podcast notes.
The wonderful podcast notes, where nobody
knows
where
they
are.
Looking at me. Yes, okay.
Thanks, Graham.
Yeah, I can put in that href.
And you can probably help us out with the last news story as well, which is that Nokia is taking over Symbian development again, because I don't really know a lot about this, but you seem to be more in tune with the situation.
I remember the story coming up on Slashdot.
Right.
Graham, you're Mr. Nokia, aren't you?
Yeah, I am, because they pay for me to go to Germany every year. Yeah. They're my very best friends. And I've said nothing but positive things about Nokia in the past, I think you remember.
Oh, really? Yes. And that Nokia t-shirt you've got on.
But yeah, isn't this... Right, now I think we talked about it in an old podcast. It wasn't so long ago that Nokia created an... They released Symbian, which is its probably the most successful mobile phone operating system in existence as open source. Great big news, because it meant that all of those cheap mobile phones that lots and lots of people, millions and millions of people use, now now running an open source operating system. I think we talked about it being fantastic for the whole free software movement. People could now take it and do whatever they wanted. And Nokia must have hoped that the results would be that people take ownership over Symbian. It becomes like a community operating system for mobile phones, and it goes from strength to strength. But that hasn't happened. I think it's probably mainly due to Android, but Nokia don't see it that way. I mean, I think was it Sony and some other mobile phone manufacturer have recently announced they're dumping Symbian for their low-powered phones and moving to Android.
Right.
And almost the week later, I mean, just a few days ago, Nokia then said, well, we're taking the Symbian source code back into our own offices, and we're going to do with it whatever we want, effectively making the Symbian Foundation that looks after the source code redundant.
Right, so...
Forking it, I suppose, or forking it back, because they can do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, I guess other people could continue their own Symbian Foundation type of setup if they wanted to do this. But it's an interesting tale because, the other handset makers pulling out of it doesn't help. But we've seen before that you can release a big bunch of source code to the world, and it won't necessarily get lots of hobbyist developers magically producing fixes. You know, Netscape threw all their source code on the internet, and it took ages for anybody to be able to plow their way through this horrible mess. And when the open office source code was dumped on the internet as well, it wasn't just somebody, anybody come along and go, I'd love to have this feature, let's do it quickly. These things take ages to clean up all the cruft that's taken place while they were
closed.
It's
the same
source
with the kernel itself, really. I mean, it's out there and it's open source, but 99.999% of anybody isn't going to touch it. And it's surely the same with Symbian. I mean, that's the equivalent, isn't it?
It's open only in theory, because there's only a real handful of kernel oligarchs like Morton and Greg Crower Hartman and people like that who ever touch it.
And I think it says more about Nokia's understanding of free software than it does about open source and free software. I think it shows that Nokia doesn't really know what it's dealing with in terms of its company strategy when it does something like this, and then in however short a period of time takes it back. What did they expect? And slightly worrying for other open source projects that they own, like Qt.
Is there a future for Symbian? I mean, now, you know, there are still, like you say, millions and millions of candy bar phones being sold out there that require a really basic OS. But as their capabilities get better and better, they're going to be able to run Android without too much hassle. So
I don't know.
Your $9.99, phone you just pick up from the shop at the moment, it makes sense to have a really basic...
My guess is that yes. I think there are, even when lots of people can afford the technology behind Android phones, there are going to be lots more people who've never had a phone, maybe. They've never been able to afford a phone, and Symbian and all those last generation bits of kit will make phones incredibly affordable for all those people. And so, yes, I think there probably is still a market for Symbian. It's still an important one.
Right.
And Nokia is the company to do it. But there you go.
Time for the discovery of the week. As we don't have Paul, that means we each have to come up with three things to fill the space.
I've got two now.
I've barely got one.
Yeah, I've only got one.
You've got 0.5 discovery.
We'll just need to talk about them for longer, or perhaps more slowly.
Without Paul picking on us, that should be quite easy.
Yeah, we're all good friends now.
Well, in that case, let's give you a little bit of time to think about your 0.5 of a discovery.
You might be able to turn it into a 1.0. Yeah.
And we'll start with Mike.
Well, I actually discovered this operating system called V7x86, which is a port of Unix version 7 to the modern PC. This was Unix from 1979. It was for the PDP 11 mini computer. This was the last Unix from Bell Laboratories before it all got commercialized by AT&T. So a lot of old school geeks regard it as the last true pure Unix. It's unbelievably bare environment when you boot it up. It's the shell is so limited. There's no command history or tab completion or anything like that. Even editing commands is a real pain, and there isn't even the V editor in there. You have to go into a contributed source directory, because that came from BSD, I think,
right?
From Berkeley. So
what is there, just ed?
Yeah, there's just Ed, yeah. So, like, the MV, the move command, has zero options, whereas if you look at today's GNU...
That's nice.
Yeah. You don't feel so... You don't feel like you're such a failure when you don't use any of those commands, you know? This is all I can do.
This is just move, and yeah. The GNU Core Utils version has 13 options, so... yeah, but what was really amazing that this operating system is 30 years old. Yeah. It's just slightly Whoa. Older than me, and I could still work my way around it. I booted it up, and I was, you know, going into Etc and looking at files there. And
so, any kind of build environment in it? I mean, what do those kind of things use?
It comes with a C compiler and assembler.
CC, I suppose.
Yeah,
or
it's
something.
Just CC. This. I'm sure it was all about under 4 megs in total size. But yeah, a C compiler. So I wrote Hello World. You know, I was writing Hello World on a 30-year-old operating system. Just and it worked, and it.
That's brilliant.
Compiled and yeah, it actually did. There were some things that were unusual, like the init binary was in the /etc directory,
right?
Whereas
right.
that would be an sbin. But yeah, apart from that, it was just like. Being at home in a really bare, austere operating system from 30 years ago. So, and it actually led me to another discovery. You know the ls command that we all assume means list?
Yes.
It actually comes from list segments. It is actually...
God. It's an acronym.
It's an yeah.
We need more of those, in fairness.
Yeah, it's... from Multics, which was the precursor to Unix, that had a command ls list segments, because there was they called files then segments and memory segments and things. So yeah, not just list, but list segments. You can tell that now to people when they think they're really clever and know what ls means. You can put them down and put them.
That's
right.
That's what I live for.
Put your fellow geeks down.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Yeah, well,
try it, everybody. It's interesting. Try it in QEMU PC emulator.
No, just install straight over the top of whatever you've got.
Wow! If you install it on a proper PC, that'd be ace.
Well, I've also discovered something old, although not quite as old as 30 years old. I installed I think you mentioned it in the podcast last fortnight. I've installed Enlightenment.
That's super duper window manager. That's always been at 0.16 forever.
Isn't it at 0.17 now?
Oh, is it? I'm behind the times.
It's E17, like the famous boy band.
Oh, right.
Of ye olden days. It's very shiny, but it's sort of a mixture between really good and really rubbish because it's just the bare bones Enlightenment. It's not been themed or anything, so it's the top bar. Is gorgeous, and the panel is nice, and there's a little you can click on your most get a sort of dock thing at the bottom, and when you click the mouse there's a little animation that shows a gleam of light being reflected from the surface of the cursor, and it's very very pretty, but the applications themselves are just bare GTK, so there's lots and lots and lots of grey. Really
right.
Horrible rectangular GTK mess. And there's the file layout is really weird when you open up the file manager. It just shows them in a list, in a vertical list, even though you've got it in icon mode.
Right.
So you can open a really big oblong? A really big landscape window, but it will still only show a vertical list of icons, which you have to scroll down to look through. It doesn't naturally fill the space there.
When I used it years ago, I always got the impression that it was a lot inspired by the Amiga, but Workbench and that file manager as well, and the file browser, but I can't really remember now. So.
Yeah, things like, you're right, you're right, the launch application on the Amiga, I can't remember what it was called, Amy Doc or something like that, looks a little bit like E17's launch panel or something like that, yeah.
I remember running Enlightenment on my old Cyrix 233 megahertz box back in the day, my first proper Linux box, and I was amazed because it actually did things like translucent windows and stuff, you know, way before Compiz and before we got used to things like that.
And it's super quick. You know, I was looking at Andrew's computer when he was using it, and, you know, you get used to the delay on KDE, but there's none of that in E17.
Well,
it's good. I think all it needs is to be brought into the fold of a decent distro who can give it some love in much the same way that that Mandriva was always the best place to try out KDE. Mm. You know, you'd not just get the bare bones KDE, you'd get it themed and you'd get sensible defaults and it was actually, it worked in a way that normal people would make it work.
Yeah.
So if it just gets that little bit of attention from someone, if there could be an, hang on, there already is an Ubuntu, isn't there?
Well, I was just thinking, I've seen on DistroWatch an Ubuntu spin-off that's heavily focused on Enlightenment, but there are so many Ubuntu spin-offs, I kind of lose track. But I think that's a really interesting point. Yeah, perhaps desktops and window managers reach their true potential when somebody takes time to really integrate them with the distro, so all your configuration tools and applications are there, and it updates when you install new applications, and it responds. So maybe that's a goal for somebody. And the next official Ubuntu spin-off. Enlightenment. Enlightenment.
Awesome.
Graham. Minty.
Yes. Minty, awesome.
Ubuntu so yesterday. I've been listening to you two, so I haven't thought of anything else. But my I can't multitask. My discovery is that YouTube is really good for DIY. I'm really rubbish at DIY, and occasionally things go wrong at home, and instructions on web pages I can't follow and quickly lose, but videos are perfect because you can just take them on your little netbook to wherever it is that you're working and follow and pause. And I've had to use this twice in the last month, one last week, and the first one was last month when my PlayStation broke. I've got a PlayStation 3, and it's the first generation one, and it had the orange light of death problem.
Oh.
Now, there was all kinds of theories online about what the problem is, but lots of people had reported they'd had success by taking them apart and using a heat, but I don't know what you call them, like a heat blower on the CPU.
Hairdryer.
Well, yeah, it is like a hairdryer, but it gets up to very, very hot temperatures, enough to melt the solder around where the CPU is socketed to the motherboard and reset the solder around the CPU. So my PlayStation was broken. It was out of warranty. I didn't have anything better to do than to do this on a Saturday afternoon. And it's quite complicated taking apart a PlayStation. I wouldn't have a clue, really, except for YouTube.
Especially resoldering a CPU. That sounds completely mental.
Yeah, so I used I found a video on YouTube that was dismantling the CPU, and it does it in real time, so I just followed it.
Right.
I just took all the same screws out, put them all at the side, took it completely to bits, got the motherboard out. I did exactly what he said. I actually followed him with his heat lamp torch thing, blower, on the CPUs. I held it on one CPU, moved it to the GPU, back to CPU, kind of went like this for 2 or 3 minutes, whatever the video said. Then found another video for putting the whole thing back together, because he said just do the reverse. But I found somebody else who was actually putting it back together. Put the whole PlayStation back together. And it worked.
Well, I think Graham's won this podcast, doesn't he?
I think Graham rules.
Graham is the winner.
Bad for Sony, because I think they know about this problem.
How does this happen? Is it some sort of vibration in the machine that's unloose?
Well, I think the consensus is that Sony uses bad quality solder. So the CPU and the GPU get to very high temperatures, and from cooling down, heating up, cooling down, the solder eventually breaks down and a connection goes.
Wow.
So it isn't a permanent solution. But by remelting the solder, you get it to work again.
How much did that console come out for? It was very expensive when
I think it cost £360.
Yeah, I mean, if this was some, you know, $14.99 Argos thing, then
it's
you
only
could
been
understand
3 years.
A low-quality solder. But on that, it reminds me of, I remember reading once an Atari ST guide on fixing your Atari ST, and it talked about lifting your ST up about a foot or 2 feet and dropping it onto the desk to reseat the chips back into their sockets.
Jeez.
So, you know, but I could never imagine this happening in a...
And our dishwasher broke last week.
Wow.
And the dishwasher came up with some stupid error, and I looked up YouTube for how. What is going on? And
the
thing is, it was a very simple problem in that the exit pipe was horizontal to the drain pipe, and so when stuff went down the sink, it started going back into our dishwasher, which caused it to have a fault.
Oh,
so but all I had to do in the end was find the bit where it went under the sink and turn it, you know, 90 degrees so that it was vertical, and it fixed the problem. And that was thanks to someone on YouTube.
Did you leave a comment on YouTube?
Great.
Did you rate the video up?
Yeah.
Give it a thumbs up.
I should have done.
Cheers, mate.
So that's it. Not Linux related at all, but that's my big discoveries.
But still home hacking.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Fixing things.
And I did have Linux on my PlayStation.
And doing something for free that would otherwise have, with a bit of mental effort, that would otherwise have cost you lots of money.
Yeah. So there you go.
Kudos. We are at the halfway point of this podcast. Coming up, You Dare Us. We've got In the Hot Seat, and it's Andrew is the victim this time, and the results of our open ballot. Stay tuned.
Okay, it's something we've all been looking forward to. It's the You Dare Us section. Now, we dared ourselves in the last episode to create an amazing T-shirt.
Well, you actually dared us, Graham, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, because we absolutely couldn't think of anything. Now, as I speak, Andrew is doing his own T-shirt right now. So, you know how rubbish we are at doing these things.
Yeah, we've both done ours, haven't we, Graham?
So, you know, Mike did his
66.6% success rate. So.
Yeah, we've done T-shirt designs. Now, Paul isn't here, but the three of us, as of now, have now done T-shirts designs.
Right.
I'll put them in the podcast notes so that you can see them. Mm. But I guess we'll talk a little bit about what we did.
I decided to use that gentle, beautiful face of Steve Ballmer for my T-shirt because I haven't got anything personal against Steve Ballmer, and I've seen him in an interview where he talks quite sensibly about a lot of things, but sometimes he just comes across as monumentally loud and crass and annoying and silly and hyperactive.
Yeah.
So I got that classic picture of him sticking his tongue out and just looking like a complete muppet. And I
said, "Is that free to use then, that picture?"
Mike.
Nobody buy my T-shirt because you might get sued. So, it appears hundreds of times on Google Images, so...
that must be all right then.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Fair use.
Your job depends on copyright laws being respected.
Oh no,
you work for a publishing company. You loon.
I'm sure I could justify it in the court that it is Steve Ballmer, and it's just what a guy. So it's a big picture of him saying, "If you use Windows, this is your daddy."
So. Yeah. Which is going to scare lots of people away.
Yeah. If you walk around wearing that T-shirt, you're in trouble. So, yeah, but please nobody buy it out of potential copyright concerns.
Yes, because you put it on Cafe Press, didn't you? Mm. I think we'll probably just make them available as pictures. Leave comments on which ones you prefer.
Yeah, if listeners say which one's best, and if anybody really, really wants one, if a load of people call out for one of these T-shirts to buy, I'm sure...
Then it would take them 2.5 minutes to come up with a similar design. do you want to talk about yours?
Yeah, totally.
It looks great, actually.
It's good, isn't it?
Andrew's very good at drawing T-shirts on pieces of paper.
It's essentially a T-shirt with the phrase 100% virus-free. And then there's an arrow pointing down to where your computer keyboard will be if you're sitting down wearing the T-shirt.
That's great. So if people are looking at you directly in Starbucks using your
laptop,
then people will know that your laptop is virus-free.
Really like that. I think it's a great idea. I think it's really good.
Thanks, Graham. It's simple.
Yeah, know? Yeah. And right, simple messages work, don't they? I think it's brilliant.
Yep. Yeah, and it can't violate any copyrights unless it's copyrighted phrase.
It's just words.
And yeah, we can't do any justice through words alone, but on the podcast.
There really should be photographs of us modelling them, but then that would be a whole new level of expense and effort and time and
remember to give
all
me
of
that,
those things.
Because I'll scan it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and put it on the notes. Seriously.
Cool.
Okay, mine. Well, I thought I'd try and help solve the age-old problem of how to pronounce Linux. Thinking that if people wore you know, the solution on a T-shirt, more people would see that it's supposed to be pronounced Linux. So what I did is I made a spectrogram of Linus Torvalds saying, hi, this is Linus Torvalds, and I pronounce Linux.
Oh, that famous OR file, AU file.
Yeah, so if people can see the spectrogram and see that, oh, he says Linux and not Linux.
Hello, this is Linus Torvalds.
Linux.
Yes, or Linux. And I put the words underneath so that there wouldn't be any kind of confusion.
Great. You might have solved one of the last great problems of modern science. So.
It looks a bit like, what's that Joy Division album?
Oh, yes, Unknown Pleasures.
Yeah, with the sound file.
That is, yeah. What was, I used to know what that sound, oh, I know. It's the graph is taken from an astronomical instrument that's measuring the pulse of a pulsar going around and around, a very famous pulsar in the sky. And it's actually the wavelength of its pulses.
That's awesome. Yeah. Did they stick a banging donk on it to make a 12-inch Ibiza dance remix?
Yeah, maybe they did. Well, presumably there's minutes between those durations, but it's very cool anyway. Because, yeah, it's cool.
Right, so that means we need a new challenge. And unfortunately, the dear listeners haven't set us one, so we're going to have to come up with one ourselves. And
Paul's T-shirt's rubbish.
Yeah, for once.
We can all say that. I thought of one. We always say that the GIMP is a really silly name for a piece of software, especially a piece of software that's supposed to be professional and one of the flagship free software projects. So why don't we all come up with the best alternative name for the GIMP? A new name that can be that sounds good, that sounds catchy, that's easy to brand, that makes people think of quality graphics editing software. So something we can really think about.
And then that's a great idea.
We can put to the community, and the community can also, you know, tell us what they think, make their suggestions, and if we have enough people, we can you know, send a petition to the GIMP developers.
So
can we register the GIMP's silly name as a bug and then get it fixed
in advance, then get it fixed and then make millions of pounds and go and buy domain names as well for
yeah,
free software probe turbo.biz. So let's do that, shall
okay
we?
Okay, I can think, and yeah, we can leave it until next episode, can't we?
Humorous names.
Blobs. Okay, cool. Right, so it's now time for
In the Hot Seat.
In the Hot Seat.
Yeah, and I'm sure it is Andrew. Andrew is the victim.
Did anyone bring the wheel down?
Oh, hold on, it's over there in the corner.
Oh, you go and get it, Graham. Right. Okay. Now, some people said they think this wheel doesn't exist, which I think is a bit offensive.
Oh, because some of this stuff is just falling off.
Yeah, well.
Okay.
It doesn't look in very good condition now, the wheel, actually. Does it need a lick of paint or something?
Well, Paul spins it far too quickly.
He does. We can say that without him being here now. He does handle
it. He doesn't know his own strength.
In too many Weetabix, I think. So, But anyway, should we spin it nice and gently this time?
Do you know what the answer's going to be?
I've absolutely no idea.
Well, there's what's on there? There's Grub, Libc, Google Chrome, we've had Firefox, weren't there? Why hasn't someone taken that off?
No, there was a sticker over the top of it, but that's peeled off now.
It's Pulse Audio now.
So, all right then, we've got a few options. Should we give it a nice, gentle spin this time?
Okay, you go for it.
Right, okay. I'm going to treat the machine with respect now, okay? There we go. Google Chrome?
Google Chrome.
Can you talk for 1 minute on Google Chrome?
Is that the browser or the OS, or is it left up to Andrew to design?
It could be both.
Well, I might have to spend the next 40 seconds clearing.
Sorry, Andrew. Yeah,
the difference between them. So, going to get the stopwatch at the ready. 3, 2, 1, go.
Google Chrome. Obviously, Google are taking over the world, and one of the ways they're doing this is with their new web browser. Initially, I think it was Eric Schmidt, one of the Google chaps, said that Google were only a small company and they weren't interested in getting into a damaging browser war of this kind that happened with Netscape and all of those ones back in the olden days. But now they're not a small company anymore, and they have their own browser, and it's taking quite a lot of market share away from Firefox. Firefox, of course, the darling of open source. You can install it on pretty much anything and install lots of extensions and stuff. Opera is moving back to the original idea behind Firefox, that it should be clean and fast and smooth, and it uses WebKit like that other browser in KDE does, and like Safari does, I think. Yes, so that puts it in good company. And there's also an operating system, which we might get to a bit later.
Yay! There we are. Well
59.8
seconds, so yeah.
I failed!
But you can have another go at it later for the operating system. So, good work, Andrew. Another job well executed.
Thanks, Mike.
Over to you, Graham.
Okay, it's now time for the open ballot.
Right.
For this episode, we asked, should KD and Qt libraries merge?
It's quite a technical one, wasn't it, this
time? It is technical. Yeah. This was a proposition made by Cornelius Schumacher, who is a long-time KDE coder. Now, I suppose a little bit, KDE is built using Qt. Now, Qt has tools and functions for drawing graphics and buttons and drawing lists and drawing web browsers, and so KDE uses all of those elements, kind of encapsulates them into their own elements, and then creates what is known as the KDE API. So KDE developers then use the KDE API to build KDE applications. So when you build a KDE application, say you put in KToolbar, KToolbar might simply be a link to QToolbar.
Just a direct link or wrapper around.
But I'm trying to simplify it. It isn't. There are cases in the past where that has just been the case. So what Cornelius is saying is that what's the point in making two levels? So you have the QT level and then the KD level. When all of KD is based on QT effectively, why not put all of the KDE bits into QT so that you don't have to import the KDE library separately? It all becomes QT. The advantage is that Qt gets access to all of the neat features in KD that it hasn't got, things like plasmids and the plasma desktop and the various windows and toolbars and menus that it uses. And the advantage for KDE is that they only have to use a single set of libraries.
Yeah, but aren't there still clear distinctions between the purposes of the two things? Qt is a primarily a toolkit library, whereas KDE is as a whole desktop infrastructure. You might want to write an application that isn't tied to a particular desktop, so you just want to use Qt. Like, you might want to write a GTK application that can run all over the place, or you might want to make it fully GNOMEified, which restricts exactly what you can do with it. So I can understand the I'm all for simplification and consolidation in the Linux desktop space. That's something I always champion. But in this case, it just seems like different needs.
The people have made lots of points that I'll come to in a minute. But I can see it does seem like I've done quite a bit of Qt programming in the last 12 months. And I've chosen Qt over KDE because it's more flexible.
Yeah,
because I write it for Linux, but if somebody else wants to build it on iOS 10 or build it on Windows, they can.
Right.
Now, this is something that the KDE team are doing independently of Qt. They're trying to make their libraries cross-platform. But if it was part of Qt, they wouldn't have to think about it. Mm. They wouldn't have to think about maintaining it. And also, there is an awful lot of cruft in KDE that they'd be forced to kind of confront and qualify if they put it into the Qt library, which may be good for Qt, may be good for KDE, but at the same time, like lots of people have mentioned in the comments, that's going to take the KDE team a long time at a point when they've only just got KDE4 usable. So I'll read some of them out. The first comment from Timothy B, he says, I think Linux should, in some cases, decide that less is more. If we mix the power of two systems into one, we have one powerful library, which is a good case, in my opinion, of course. He goes on to say, I just feel like saying that Linux doesn't need 1,000 options, we just need a good few options, which I think is right. In fact, most people, I don't know whether it's been the trend for our last few episodes, but most people have decided on the, it's probably a good thing if it reduces the complexity. Zoe Hanetto, if KDE libs and Qt would merge, it would reduce a lot of duplication. It would also mean that mainstream developers would learn KDE library stuff. That's true. Big Brother, I find this a very good move. Many times we've talked about consolidation in Linux, and merging of KDE libraries is a good step towards achieving that. This, if carried through, would eliminate many duplicate efforts and would make life easier for developers. But in the end, I think that the result would be worth the effort. I don't know how to pronounce this. Felim Whitley. Looks like an Irish pronunciation.
No idea.
Sounds promising. If it can be done and done properly without causing a horrendous mess of KDE in the process, I think it would be excellent.
Have any Qt developers said anything about this yet? We've heard everything from the KDE camp and all the discussions there.
I didn't follow the link, so I don't know. I mean, I imagine they'll be in two minds about it. In fact, they must want to keep it. A lot of KDE developers are employed by Trolltech, or they used to be.
I'd imagine there's a lot of crossover, between them. So.
I mean, also, there has been kind of cross... There's no reason why Nokia and Qt and Trolltech, the old Trolltech, there's no reason stopping them bringing KDE technologies back into Qt. They did it with Phonon, which was the audio layer in KDE4, because it meant that they could have cross-platform compatibility for playing sounds, which seemed like a great idea. They took the whole thing and they put it back into Qt. But Phonon has been dropped because it was too complicated and too complex to maintain. So I think from Nokia's point of view, they're never going to want it. They're never going to want those crufty KD technologies.
Right.
If
that set a precedent, then yeah, that's going to be tough.
Presumably, if you merged KDE and Qt libraries, then they'd get a lot bigger.
Yeah, that's true.
And so if you were a big company trying to minimize the amount of stuff you put on your mobile phone operating system, you wouldn't like it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, in fact, for the future, I think we've touched on it, Qt's becoming modular. So companies can choose the libraries that they want, so they don't have to have the KD library. But at the same time, it's modular now, isn't it? KD is a module, if you look at it like that.
Yeah.
Kevin Collier. Nokia bought Qt for its cross-platform use for smartphone applications. KD is a desktop software, although it's gaining some netbook and smartphone spin-offs. And this was originally the starting point of the project. Nokia is unlikely to want to support the desktop classes long-term, even though there is short-term benefit. What would they? Why would they? It's simply not their business. It's pointless work. As a long-term KD desktop user who has a functioning desktop again, at last, just, he says, the idea of huge amounts of developer time poured into some sideways work like this is deeply annoying. A plea to KD devs, don't mess with the libraries again. Deliver us the best experience for desktop users, please. And a lot of people say that.
Yes, I saw a lot of people have the same sentiment, because KD4 is, in a lot of people's minds, getting just to the point now where it's really stable,
yeah,
and featureful.
Yeah.
And you know, after a lot of problems with the early releases, they're really getting a good desktop together. And now they're talking about throwing everything in the air.
And I have to agree. I think that's what I'd say. I think, firstly, Nokia aren't going to want it. They didn't want phone on, and there's nothing stopping them taking the bits they like now anyway.
That's true. They could have done it already.
Yeah. Secondly, KDE, they've got a lot. They've already got too much work on their plate. Another note from Giacomo L. KDE just only got back to a decent state after 2 years in the wilderness. Another big migration would alienate even more users and app developers. This is a terrible idea. Scarce development resources should be dedicated to more productive things like fixing multi-monitor support, helping poor PIM suite, improving usability. You can't switch off Bluetooth, etc., etc. Other people saying they'd like it. Count Docula, KD is all about integration. Count Docula would welcome this move.
So it really seems a lot of people would like it on technical grounds, but on the fact that it would be another hindrance to KD development.
I think so. I think that's the main problem. I mean, KD haven't proven themselves to be very effective at doing this kind of stuff. Maybe only just got on top.
From a practical level as well, they don't need to be reinventing any more wheels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let Nokia worry about it, I think. A resounding no from Chen. They say, I feel like I'm watching a horrible accident progressing in slow motion, yelling no from the top of my lungs, but powerless to affect the outcome in any way. KD4 is almost as usable as KD3 had been. Just another point release or two and I will be home again. This is the worst time to break it horribly again.
Aww.
And as if we didn't learn anything from Oracle, step away from the large corporation. Slowly, slowly, now run.
Best comment ever.
There's a few more yeses, a few more mess. Hugh... says, what on earth does all this mean? And maybe from Apophis. And Ray Wood says, as long as it works.
Ah.
So a mixed bag. Lots of people saying no. Other people saying, we like the idea of things getting simpler, but I think it's impossible.
I think you're right. Nokia can already take what they want and put it into Qt. That's something they can do all naturally, organically, without having to throw everything together in one big lump.
Yeah, let's leave Qt as it is.
Yeah.
Right, well, I guess I should do this.
Yeah, you wrap up this podcast then, Graham.
Right, so that's the end of our 21st podcast. We've come of age.
We've still got it all wrong, haven't we? Because...
No, don't I have the power to veto this now? I'm doing the outro.
So you don't want a one more thing? Oh, no, on.
Everyone would kill me go on. I'm sorry, Mike.
They'd kill you even more.
Kill me even more. I'd be
twice
even more
as dead.
Well, while you guys try and work out what that means, let me give my one more thing. We were talking before about Unix being the successor to the Multics operating system, and Unix, before it was UNIX, was originally UNICS. Can anybody say what that stood for?
I'm sorry, what was that? Genuinely, my mind just flashed to something else.
University of Northallerton Integrated Computing System.
Well, you've got computing system,
yeah!
So
So I have to work out what UNICS
is. Yeah, so, the old name for Unix before it was ended in X.
Unix.
Unix not is
not a computing system.
No, I don't know.
That would be brilliant. Actually, the Uniplexed Information and Computing System. And I actually found out as well that the Multics, the precursor to Unix, which dates back to 1964, there was actually a serious Multics installation running at the Canadian Department of National Defence until 2000.
Wow.
So that's impressive longevity. Sweet.
That is really good. That is great.
Yeah. So there we go.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mike. Thanks to you all for listening. This has been episode 21. Hopefully, Paul will be back next time.
See you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Bye.